Welcome to an Interside Radio Program special Fun Drive edition. Sitting in for me this week is Walrus O'Donnell in a minimalist mix by yours truly with the Beatles. And Grox Science interviews Sam Harris.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing. I'm you. I'm not a witch. I'm nothing. I'm you. I'm you. None of us are perfect. Sitting on a cornflake, waiting for the van to come. Corporation t-shirt, stupid bloody Tuesday man. You've been a naughty boy, you let your face grow long. I am the Eggman, they are the Eggmen. I am the Walrus, Mr. City Policeman. Go to Washington.
I'm crying.
And do what you do. I'm Christine O'Donnell.
Yellow man of custard. Dripping from a dead dog's eye.
And I approve this message.
Grab a lock of fishwife, pornographic priestess. Boy, you've been a naughty girl. You let your knickers down. I am the Eggman.
None of us are perfect. I'm not a witch. I'm nothing.
Dr. Sam Harris. Harris is a neuroscientist who gained quite a bit of attention from his paper examining the neural correlates of religious versus non-religious beliefs. He's the CEO of Project Reason, the author of two New York Times bestsellers titled The End of Faith and Letters to a Christian Nation, and he's with us today to discuss his newest book titled The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values. So Dr. Harris, welcome to the Grok Science Show.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
Oh, wonderful. So your book is titled The Moral Landscape. What is a moral landscape? Let's start with that.
Well, that's a framework I use to think about questions of right and wrong and good and evil in universal terms. It's a landscape of all possible conscious experience where the peaks correspond to the heights of happiness or well-being, and the valleys correspond to the lowest depths of suffering. And it's a way to think about changes in conscious experience and to think about questions of morality and human values in that context.
So you just used the C word, and that's often a controversial word to use as a neuroscientist. Charles and I are both neuroscientists.
We pretend to be.
Yes, we pretend to be. I want to know how your book, it's about letting science guide you through this moral landscape. But
right.
how are we supposed to use science to understand morals?
First, we should distinguish answers in practice from answers in principle. There are obviously many facts about the universe that we can't, that are currently scientifically intractable, although we can't actually acquire the data, and some are in practice always going to be out of reach, and yet we know that these truths exist. I mean, if I were to, there's no team of scientists who could tell us how many birds are in flight over the surface of the Earth at this moment, and yet we know there's just a simple numerical answer to that question. We do science in the face of a larger reality which has innumerable questions like that, so we have this background of facts. And what I'm arguing is that because conscious experience arises in some way dependent upon the laws of nature, and we don't obviously understand it in all its details, but we know that it's not entirely random. We know that every way of living isn't the equivalent of every other way of living in terms of producing, in our case, human well-being, then we know that there must be right and wrong answers to this question. What I'm arguing is that there must be right and wrong ways to move across what I call the moral landscape, even if there are multiple peaks on it, even if there are multiple equivalent ways for human beings to thrive, both personally and collectively, and I think there probably are. There are clearly many ways not to thrive. There are many ways to completely fail to live a life that maximizes well-being or positive social emotions like compassion and empathy and trust. It's possible for societies to completely fail to produce lives worth living. And we know something about this, and all of these details, though complex when you get into them, fall into the sciences of genetics and neuroscience and psychology and sociology and economics. I mean, every variable that can influence states of the human brain will be relevant in the end to a full understanding of human well-being.
You use the word variable, and you mentioned many, many different variables, and I'm having a hard time understanding one of the main concepts of the book, which would be science and morality together, because in science we examine things using the scientific method. How would you suggest that one might be able to control for all of these factors that would make up one's moral character?
Well, my core argument is that we know certain moral truths even before we go into the lab at this point. And we know, for instance, that life in Afghanistan under the Taliban is not a way of maximizing human well-being. You know, throwing battery acid in the face of a little girl for the crime of learning to read is just not a good strategy for raising happy children or competent adults or building a society that allows the most people to flourish. I mean, this is just so patently obvious. And what I'm saying is that is not, most people in science seem to think that something has occurred in the last 200 years that has made it problematic to speak about moral truth in a transcultural way, right, from the point of view of science. But what I'm saying is the moment you link morality to questions of human and animal well-being, then clearly there are truths to be known about it, and clearly there are obviously wrong ways to live. And to pretend that we can't say that the Taliban are wrong, really wrong, not from the point of view of science, they're really wrong about human well-being, is to pretend that we know nothing about human well-being. It's to pretend that you know, while we have 150 years of brain science and psychology and sociology behind us, and we've made some real gains in the treatment of women in our culture and in equity between the sexes, maybe forcing half the population to live in cloth bags is as good as anything we've come up with. And we just know it's not an intellectually honest position, and yet it's one that I continually run into in the ivory tower. People think that values and morality are a no-go area for science in normative terms. All we can do is descriptively notice what people are doing in the name of morality, but there's no place to stand from which to say anyone is ever right or wrong, and that's the chief thing I'm disputing.
What do we do, though, if, for instance, my well-being, which people can argue in a certain part of my life could be considered a good, happy life, could be considered well-being for me, but it could also be causing suffering down the line for a bunch of people, say, in sub-Saharan Africa.
Right. That kind of moral problem is something, obviously, that we run into, and there are situations where there's a zero-sum trade-off between one person's happiness and another. You know, if there's one slice of pie left and only one person can have it, there are trade-offs of that sort. But I think the most important moral occasions are ones that are generally not zero-sum. There are some very obvious things we could do to make life better for more or less everyone in our global civilization. I mean, eradicating the causes of deadly pandemics, nuclear proliferation, terrorism, the causes of war. I mean, all of this would be good for everybody on balance. There'd be no losers. So those are obviously right things to do. And when you talk about kind of radically zero-sum, internecine, everyone for himself moments on this landscape, clearly they're not going to be peaks on the landscape. There are situations in which one person can be made happy by the slavery of others.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not denying that it's possible. There are kind of pathological states of happiness that people can experience. I think a suicide bomber, before he pushes the button, is probably experiencing some kind of religious ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could trade places with him at that moment, you would be experiencing quite a thrill. But that kind of happiness is not the durable basis for most of the people most of the time to be truly happy. So it by definition wouldn't be a peak on what I'm calling the moral landscape.
I don't disagree with you at all. The issue that I'm having is the things that we can inarguably say, these are right. Science is about quantification. How do we quantify these values?
Well, again, you're asking in practice, and I think the deeper point is made in principle. Now, in practice, yes, I think we will understand states like compassion and joy and love at the level of the brain, and we will quantify them. I mean, we will understand the genes that allow people to feel compassion and the genes that the variants that lead to psychopathy, say,
mm-hmm.
And the kinds of brain injuries that lead to psychopathy. And
sure.
We're beginning to understand that now. But the deeper principle is, imagine a universe in which every conscious creature, humans and animals and anything that can have any experience whatsoever, suffers as much as it possibly can for as long as it can. In my book, I call this the worst possible misery for everyone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, that's bad. And if anything is bad, that is. And what I argue is that given that state of affairs is related to the laws of nature in some way, I mean, conscious experience is constrained by the laws of nature and therefore falls within the purview of science, any movement away from that worst possible misery for everyone is going to be a movement towards something better by definition. And so the moment you acknowledge that continuum exists, that it's possible for everything to suffer as much as it possibly can suffer for as long as it possibly can, and there's a possibility of movement away from that, there's clearly going to be right and wrong ways to move, and
mm-hmm.
there's going to be there are better and worse ways to avoid the worst possible misery for everyone, and that's it seems to me that's all I need to ground morality and values squarely in the context of a growing scientific understanding of mental life. But I think even in stronger terms than that, I don't see any other intelligible way to talk about morality. And this, I think, would change, just admitting this much, would change our discourse so that when, for instance, you notice an institution like the Catholic Church talks about morality and values, but they're actually more concerned about preventing contraception than the rape of children.
Sure.
That inversion of priorities, I mean, they're clearly not really tracking the details of human well-being in any intelligible way there. That is analogous to them talking about the physics of the transubstantiation or the physics of the Holy Ghost. I mean, they could use the word physics in that way, but we wouldn't have to take them seriously. And I'm saying that we don't have to take them seriously when they talk about morality and values, when they're actually not talking about the well-being of conscious creatures.
I agree. I'm proud to call myself an atheist, an anti-theist, and in many, if not most, respects of your book, it was like preaching to the choir. But with all due respect, I think that there may be something very unscientific about exploring concepts of human values and morality. Yet what you suggest is good science isn't the result of scientists abstaining from making value judgments. And I thought that was really interesting, and I was hoping you would expand on that.
Yeah, there's this notion that there's this separation between facts and values, and science just deals in facts, and values are something science can really never get a hold of. But the problem with that description is that when you look at the kinds of facts that science deals in, we only get to an agreement on those facts based on values, based on a valuing evidence, valuing logical coherence, valuing parsimony, valuing mathematical elegance in certain spheres of science.
Sure.
We have to value understanding the universe. And when you confront someone who doesn't share those values, the conversation just falls apart. There is no common ground. And yet, in every other area of science, we don't take that as a problem. When the creationist comes to the paleontology conference and says, well, listen, I'm the way I talk about paleontology is just whatever fits the book of Genesis, that person proves his or her inadequacy to the conversation. And yet we seem to believe that differences of opinion on morality, when someone comes to the morality conference and says, well, I get my morality out of Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy, somehow that difference of opinion erodes the basis of moral truth. And I think that is a double standard in our reasoning that is ultimately incoherent, but also quite harmful to our building a global civilization based on shared values.
There's a part of me that finds a certain amount of comfort, and I don't know if that's the best way to describe it, on keeping ideas of morality separate from concepts that may be proven with the scientific method. I'm afraid that people that have religious beliefs, if they don't do that, I worry if that could lead to the idea that one needs to choose between science and religion.
One does need to choose between holding beliefs for good reasons and holding beliefs for bad reasons. I mean, there really is a conflict there. And I think we obscure that at our peril. Now, obviously, there are some political moves that may be prudent in certain circumstances, and I certainly wouldn't recommend that anyone make the kinds of noises I make about religion in all contexts. I don't go to Mecca and hold a public lecture on expressing my views of Islam, for instance.
Sure.
But
well, that might get you in a little trouble, yeah.
Yeah, that would be the swift end of a career. I think there's a deep analogy between talking about morality in terms of human well-being and talking about human health. I mean, really, I'm talking about mental health and the health of societies.
Mm-hmm.
And so... When you just change the terms in that way, it clearly falls within the context of science. I mean, mental health, the concept of physical health is a loose concept, which is continually changing, continually absorbing changes in the way human beings live and breakthroughs in science. We have different expectations about human health at this point. And yet, we have a science of medicine, which is a real science. There's no question that there are right and wrong answers to questions about how diseases spread and how certain genes affect our longevity, etc. Now, simply obvious, should be obvious, that because states of human consciousness are arising on the basis of some psychophysical laws, I mean, the brain is the basis for human experience, and influences upon it based on the behavior of other people and the states of the world, that is the stuff of which our subjectivity, upon which our subjectivity is built.
Of course.
All of this has to fall within science. It's just the details are incredibly complicated, but the general principles are pretty obvious. And it's pretty obvious that living in Congo at this moment, where most people are worrying about being raped or killed by drug-addled soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not—it's not an ideal circumstance for human well-being. And which is to say that one would be—it would not be moral to intentionally produce that circumstance for people.
Of
it would
course.
Be a bad thing. And but again, I think that's a claim that is as strong a scientific claim as saying that it is unhealthy to drink cyanide, or that spreading smallpox around is not good for children in terms of their health. I mean, this is just those are scientific claims. They're not these whimsical value judgments. I mean, smallpox really does kill people,
mm-hmm.
And we understand something about it. Well, psychopathy is really bad for human relationships, and we can begin to understand something about that, and indeed we are.
The one thing that I worry about is I don't think I can convince anyone to share my lack of religious beliefs, and just like religious believers would never be able to get me to join in on their team. But nonetheless, I want people to see that science can show you profound and tangible truths. So in other words, I mean, you believe your thing, I won't believe in your thing, but let's both agree that science has proven to us that X, Y, and Z has occurred. And I'm just thinking that this might be a little bit more of a realistic approach to make science a little bit more friendly and not frightening.
Right. Well, I mean, you're raising a political concern, and I'm talking about what is actually true here. Because, if, for instance, you can't convince a majority of the American population that evolution occurred, but that doesn't for a moment put evolutionary biology into question. I mean, evolutionary biology is thriving despite the fact that most people don't believe in it. Now, that's true of, I mean, we simply don't anchor science to, we don't put science to a vote, you know, on democratic principles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible for the majority of human beings to be wrong about anything.
Sure.
And it's possible for the majority or for everyone to be wrong about the possibilities of human well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I find this notion of a moral landscape useful. It's possible for all of us to be wrong about how to move upward,
mm-hmm.
From where we currently are. And I think that's, yes, it's, you have to pick your moments when you're going to go to the mat to try to erode someone's unjustified beliefs. But certain beliefs are hugely consequential, and they're causing an immensity of unnecessary human suffering. And we can't merely respect them and wait for them to go away. I mean, we're on a collision course with people who think that the end of the world will in some sense be a good thing, that we're either going to be raptured by Jesus or Islam will reign triumphant. I mean, there are millions and millions of people who subscribe to some very implausible ideas which justify extraordinary misuses of human life and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we just have to begin speaking honestly about the status of these ideas.
So this is a very fascinating idea, the moral landscape that you've presented here, but it still seems like a bit of an assertion. What do you think it would take to eventually arrive at a scientific description of morality?
Well, I think it's like asking the same question about physical health. I mean, I just heard you say you're simply asserting that physical health has something to do with not dying young, not being in excruciating pain, not being debilitated by infectious disease, etc. You just gave us a list of assertions. Well, who are you to say that that's what physical health is? How could you ever convince someone with end-stage Alzheimer's that they're not as healthy as you are? Now, it's possible to give voice to those doubts, but clearly, medicine is no one is tempted to attack the philosophical foundations of medicine with those kinds of doubts, and yet everyone seemingly wants to attack a scientific understanding of morality in terms of human and animal well-being by the same rationale. I just think it's a bizarre double standard, because I think well-being even supersedes a concern for physical health. I mean, well, why is physical health important to us? I mean, I think it's one category of a more general concept of well-being that interests everyone, and whether or not they think of it in those terms. I mean, we simply, you know, everyone who is running for their life in Congo at this moment can dimly imagine some change in their state of being that they would prefer, whether they have a free moment to spare to think about it. And we can understand the neurology of those states of consciousness, the social systems that encourage certain experiences. We can have breakthroughs in economics that create systems of greater trust and kind of ease the friction of relationships between strangers. I mean, there's all kinds of changes that could happen in the world that could improve, that could be a tide that would basically raise all boats. And all of this is clearly anchored to facts about, crucially, the human brain and the way in which human subjectivity is arising on the basis of its changes.
Let me just apologize for 2 seconds. I don't want to make you think. I apologize for giving you a hard time throughout all of this.
No. I appreciate it. I mean, I'm not at all. I don't want to duck any of your questions.
No. I don't feel like you did. You took the punch as well. The book was fascinating, and it really, really makes you think. It makes you question how you do think. And a lot of our listeners are scientists, and I think it would be very good for them to check this out.
Indeed. The book is The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Humanistic Values.
Thank you, Grok Science, sitting in for Innerside Radio this Fun Drive week. Here's a little voiceover humor from David Feldman at KPFK. My name is Scooter, and I'll see y'all next week.
Chet Perkins is a voiceover artist who lives in New York City. You've heard his voice on commercials for John McCain, Barack Obama, and the Olive Garden. Sounds like Chad Perkins will say nice things about anybody. If the money's right. I guess that's just how they do things in New York City. I'm Bill Jenkins, and I approve this message. Paid for by the Bill Jenkins Committee for Responsible Voice Work. Voiceover artist Bill Jenkins has a problem. Bill Jenkins said in a series of commercials blanketed throughout all of California that teachers' unions are too powerful. At the same time, Bill Jenkins' voice was all over the airwaves in Texas, saying teachers' unions were just fine. Which one is it, Bill? Flip, flop. I'm Chad Perkins, and I approve this ad. Paid for by Citizens United for voiceover reform. Chad Perkins, Chairman. It's easier to face the day feeling fresh. Summer's Eve. Look and feel your best.
There he goes again, reading an endorsement for a product he doesn't even use. Turns out voiceover artist Chad Perkins will read just about anything they put in front of him. Claims it's his job.
Cyberbullying isn't cool, and it hurts. For more information, go to stopcyberbullying.org.
What are you selling today, Chad? Do we need voiceover artists who are in the pocket of big advertising? Is that good for America? Bill Jenkins doesn't think so. I'm Bill Jenkins, and I approve of this ad. Paid for by the committee that thinks Chad Perkins is a douchebag.
Bill Jenkins was all over the airwaves last night, telling the good people of Kansas that marriage is a union between a man and a woman. How would he know? Isn't Bill Jenkins still living on that farm with his mother? Kind of strange for a man in his 50s. I'm Chad Perkins, and I approve this ad. Paid for by the Committee to Preserve Traditional Voiceover Work.
Chad Perkins and his wife Jenny have 3 boys, Dylan, Kyle, and Henry. But hold on a second. Chad and Jenny have had sex hundreds, if not thousands, of times. What happened to all those other babies Jenny conceived? They all just disappeared? Chad, the next time you're recording a radio spot for Focus on the Family, why don't you ask Dr. James Dobson what happened to all those innocent, unborn babies? I'm Bill Jenkins, and I'm not gay. Paid for by Charlie Crist for Senate, 2010.